political changes virtually crippling the Central American nation. Participants in the massive strike and protests included the National Forum, the Caja Workers Union, teachers' unions, dock workers, healthcare workers, various public and private institutions, private transport drivers, motorcycle owners, community organizations, and even Frente Amplio, Broad Front. The group said they were striking and protesting against a host of issues affecting the country, including corruption and impunity of public officials, controversial government concessions, the killing of environmentalist Jairo Mora, which Vice President Alfio Diva called an accident, the case of lawmaker Jorge Angulo, who was accused of extortion, President Laura Chinchilla's use of a private jet, linked to a Colombian businessman who was investigated for drug trafficking, the privatization of ports, the closing of a health clinic in Montes de Oca, social inequality, and deteriorating public services, among others. Union leaders told the press that Tuesday's protest
le fusil, la mitraille, les grenades, France sur la balle.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
C'est nous qui frissons le barreau des prisons pour nos frères. À nous toute la faim qui nous pose en misère. Il est des pays où les gens au creux de l'île font de frère. Ici.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web. ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
Sometimes you have to laugh to keep from crying. So let me, at considerable risk, let me say, I'd like to tell you a little joke. I know how that may sound a bit weird in this context under these circumstances, but I think you're the perfect audience for it. As long as you if you don't like it or you don't think it's funny or inappropriate, that you don't hold it against Mr. Zimmerman. You can hold it against me if you want, but not Mr. Zimmerman. I have your assurance you won't. Here's how it goes. Knock, knock. Who's there? George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman, who? All right, good. You're on the jury. Nothing? That's funny. After what you folks have been through the last two or three weeks?
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. White man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart Aboriginals.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Final question before for you, but I'd like you to hang around. I just want to get Pete Williams in here as well. To the extent that you have aided and abetted Snowden, even in his current movements, why shouldn't you, Mr. Greenwald, be charged with a crime?
I think it's pretty extraordinary that anybody who would call themselves a journalist would publicly muse about whether or not other journalists should be charged with felonies. The assumption in your question, David, is completely without evidence, the idea that I've aided and abetted him in any way. The scandal that arose in Washington before our stories began was about the fact that the Obama administration is trying to criminalize investigative journalism by going through the emails and phone records of AP reporters, accusing a Fox News journalist of the theory that you just embraced, being a co-conspirator with felonies for working with sources. If you want to embrace that theory, it means that every investigative journalist in the United States who works with their sources, who receives classified information, is a criminal. And it's precisely those theories and precisely that climate that has become so menacing in the United States is why the New Yorker's Jane Mayer said investigative reporting has come to a standstill, her word, as a result of the theories that you just referenced.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
Internet radio for smarter Aboriginals.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Salutan and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, the Angry Indian. Editor-in-Chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the Fourth World from aboriginalpressnews.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com and ang-newswire.blogspot.com. Thank you for tuning in to Indigenous News, thought and analyses concerning the issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under imperial, theological, racist, neo-classist, neo-colonialist, neo-liberal, neo-fascist, and in neo-misogynist control. I wish to welcome you all to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, welcome along. I wish peace the gods and earths, and love and solidarity to the entire original family in this time of strife and struggle. This is the Angry Indian, sitting in with our engineer and executive producer, as always, Guadalupe Morales. Again, we've had a few things to come in here and talk about, but, what does that mean? Because once I sit here and start looking through the news feeds and seeing what's, going on in the current, all of that goes out the window. It's just because so much is happening so fast. And frankly, you really don't know what the hell to believe. Because we did a show here yesterday. No. A couple of days ago. Because we got information that came from one news source, it turns out, the United States, from Las Vegas. Which turns out is not, I don't want to say it's not a legitimate news source, but let's just say, they were super wrong on this one. But then again, the AP has been wrong. They were out here reporting that the Republicans had passed some measure that closed off abortion clinics, and it turns out that that wasn't true. What am I saying? It wasn't true. Let me just say what the fuck it really is, right? It was a fucking lie. you know, and they really dogged the Republicans in that state. The one female Democrat who filibustered for 10 hours. They did everything to try to get her off the podium. I mean, they tried every point of voter call they could, but, you know, she managed to tough it out, and she was up there for 10 hours straight. So you really have to credit this individual sister for being able to do that, because, you know, how many other people could do that, you know, have that kind of fight in them to realize there's really nobody else and that I have to do this. You know, so, you know, where was journalism? Well, you know, the AP reported that this thing had passed. I just don't understand how they could make a mistake like that. I mean, on the other hand, okay, they believe what they're told, right? But, you know, we who are not the AP, we who are not the New York Times, we who are not John King, doing the Boston chaos not too long ago, talking about, well, somebody's going to get the story right. You know, we're just a humble little, you know, grassroots news service here, meaning that we, unless somebody is actually on scene and can give us some first-person reportage, that we are relying upon the Associated Press and Reuters and the New York Times and what have you, like everybody else. And if you remember the late Colonel Fletcher Prady, you know, by the time the people in the White House or what have you, you know, but by the time the authorities get through with the real news and tell the news agencies what they're going to report or what they're not going to report, you know, we just get what's left, which really isn't news. You know, we don't get anything. You know, we just get a lot of, you know, purposeful confusion, you know, the manufacture of confusion. Which, if you read that book by Professor Noam Chomsky, you realize that he didn't invent that term, and that he lists Reinhold Niebuhr, which I suggest that you look up his work and read it directly. And he also brought up Eddie Bernays. There's been some talk about him lately, mostly because of Adam Curtis from the BBC. And that's a good thing, because the grandnephew of Sigmund Freud has done a lot of damage. And this is why when motherfuckers want to argue with me about how Freud was, you know, Freud was wrong. Oh, Freud was wrong. You know, you keep hearing that, right? You know, folks, you know, like me who have some, you know, educational training in psychology, you know, they always, you know, you always hear that. Oh, Freud was wrong. Freud was wrong. Then you ask them, well, what was he wrong about? You know, where was he wrong? Oh, the whole, you know, sexual thing. Oh, you know, the whole idea of the id. Oh, you know, all of that. All it's all nonsense. It's all nonsense. Well, I mean, what do we know now? Anyone who does the research on Bernays, his American relative. Well, we find out that that whole controversy about Freud being wrong was actually started by Ernie Bernays. That was the way to sell the books. That was how he got the controversy that got him into the mainstream media. He actually created the idea that Freud was completely wrong because he understood the morality of the United States. It's hypocritical. It's completely Anglo-Saxon. It's hypocritical. You know, it's hypocritical. I mean, it's still suffering from Victorianism in many, many ways. See, they use sex to sell every goddamn thing. Because it's a drive, and it's really hard to, you know, for a lot of folks, really. It's hard for just about anybody, but it's hard for most folks to really deal with their sexuality. To be comfortable with their sexuality. To be able to discuss, you know, within correct terms, within correct conditions, within correct parameters, what have you. To discuss the issue of human sexuality in an objective and mindful way. You know, they don't do that. You know, the entire cycle of life doesn't dawn on them. You know, it's just, it's wrong, it's nasty. And what does it come down to? Because folks really don't have a whole lot of control over what the hell they're attracted to. You don't have any control over what you're attracted to sexually. But also, you know, you also have to, you know, take into account that your sexual orientation, just like everything else within your culture, within your personal makeup, has a lot to do with your personal experiences. So, I mean, if you come from a, you know, if you come from Latin America, you like a woman who is, you know, pretty shapely. I mean, there's a certain parameter because that's what's there. If you come from the African community, you know, say in the United States, which is my experience, you know, there's a certain look. There's a certain body type, you know, for males and for females that's considered attractive. And that's the litmus test, so to speak. Now, what I'm saying here is not a matter of what's right and what's wrong and what's bad or what's good. I'm saying let's look at it objectively. What you're attracted to in terms of sexual orientation and in many ways in terms of your actual behavior is a real hard thing to control, because we're talking about biological drives. Now, as I said on the earlier show, you had an American politician that really made a stupid comment. And the way that he brought it out, even though he said something that was factual, he was really ridiculous and misogynistic. And just, you know, it was chauvinistic as well as being misogynistic, which I suppose goes hand in hand. But it was the chauvinism that really got me about it. Because the attitude was, well, boys will be boys. Now, we're talking about the issue of military sexual assault. And if it seems like I'm rambling, I actually am. Because, you know, like I said, we have no script here. You know, we printed a couple of things out. And I'm going to go on about a few things. But this is what's going through my mind right now as I'm sitting here, as I'm talking to you. If you're confused, then, you know, I really apologize for that, but, you know, this is the way it goes. Military sexual abuse, you know, just to say that it's a real problem really isn't saying any goddamn thing. And I suppose one of the reasons why this is on my mind is because, you know, I had a discussion with someone last night, a vet. You know, he pretty much flat out told me that he doesn't believe that anyone is being sexually assaulted in the military. I mean, we talked for a couple of minutes, and then he had to cop on. Well, if that's happening, that's pretty bad. But he just flat out, just, you know, refused to accept it. And for the most part, probably still does. You know, when it comes to torture and everything else, I mean, he didn't want to accept that either until he just got to the point where he had to. After the, you know, expose of Abu Ghraib became open, and now that we understand the torture is approved and what have you, John Yoo, you know, who had the nerve to come out and say something about Snowden. Can you believe that? That's goddamn chutzpah. I mean, really. You know, that is a classic goddamn example of unlimited fucking gall, you know, for John Yoo, of all people, to have anything to say about the Edward Snowden affair. And like I said, you know, I don't know what the hell is going on. You don't know what the hell is going on other than what's being reported. I mean, are we really supposed to believe what we're hearing, that he had some long-term plan on doing this? And now he's, I suppose, hooked up with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, which, you know, seems natural. I mean, it makes sense. You know, they're both doing the same thing, and they're both basically in the same goddamn position. So, you know, I mean, that only makes sense. I don't know why that's such a big surprise. And I really, again, as I've said before, I don't know why anybody is fucking surprised about all this goddamn surveillance. You know, I mean, a lot of people that I knew, you know, a lot of, you know, conservative people, most of them vets, they just took it for granted that once this started, that they were going to start collating information. I did as well. You know, anybody who understands anything at all about what the intelligence community is supposed to be, and I'm not talking about movies, I'm talking about reading their own literature. You know, I mean, Spycatcher is just, I don't know, I must read that about 2 times a year. You know, it's a good book. It's an interesting book. I read Kissinger's books. I have 2 here, you know. His book on diplomacy is an excellent read. It's an excellent read. I've also read the PNAC documents after the Irish Times, you know, made that public. You know, I mean, the information is out here. Why not look at it? why not look at it? You know, how can you understand the world if you don't look at it? You know, that's why when people tell me, oh, I would never read Mein Kampf. Why not? How the hell can you really understand what was going through Hitler's mind as he was planning all of this if you don't read Mein Kampf? You can't look at the results of something and think that you understand the entire thing. That doesn't make any sense. Because all you're dealing with is the superficial. You have to get deeper in. And I'm not necessarily talking about psychohistory. Because I know a lot of folks got upset when I talked about Adolf Hitler being gay. It wasn't me. You know, and, you know, Lothar Machtan, who wrote The Hidden Hitler, you know, which a lot of this research is based on, he's not the only person to have said this. You know, this was common knowledge in Germany at the time. This was written about while Hitler was still alive, the first year or so he became chancellor, they were talking about him like this. You know, the same thing with Rudolf Hess. I mean, his reputation, you know, was pretty widespread. Yeah, now, was any of it true? How the hell do I know? I don't know. You know, I mean, members of the Wagner family have been public about this, that they believe that Hitler was a practicing homosexual up until he became chancellor, in which, you know, his life changed. You know, he wasn't able to do anything. I mean, we're talking about somebody who, I'm not even talking about his closest male friend, August Kupacek. And I'm not even talking about the when he served in World War I on the front, actually. You know, he was awarded for bravery. He won the cross twice, I believe, for bravery. But there was somebody that he was supposed to have had a sexual relationship with, according to his war record. Supposedly, this is documented in his war record. So, you know, you go out there and you do the research, you know, and yeah, you know, it's uncomfortable for a lot of people. And I don't know why. You know, J. Edgar Hoover and his husband, Clyde Tolson, created the Federal Bureau for Investigation, right? You know, they made that organization what it is today, you know, and it's like they were gay, but nobody wants to hear about it because they were negative. So, you know, let's not look at it. You know, let's not look at it. You know, Hitler might have been a homosexual. I mean, he did actually run the largest pogrom against homosexuals in all of European history. I mean, he did his best to wipe out gay folks. And frankly, he got to them before he got the Jews. I mean, well, he got the Turks before he got the Jews, right? Right? I mean, you know, nobody discusses that. You know, and it's not to say that we should not be knowledgeable and we should not recognize what happened to Jews during the European Holocaust. But are we not going to acknowledge the homosexual victims? Are we not going to not acknowledge the Rom or Gypsy victims? Are we not going to acknowledge the Sudanese German victims? You know, we talked about that before. You know, at the end of World War I, the French, when they were occupying Germany, they brought in their Sudanese troops. And some of them stayed. And they had children. They raised families. They became, you know, Germans. They became German citizens anyway, and their children were raised to be German. You know, they didn't know anything different. And they were rounded up. You know, for whatever reason, actually, when you do the research on this, many did end up in the camps. Well, quite a few actually, I mean, again, you know, no one really wants to talk about this. Quite a few were castrated so that they couldn't reproduce. They were sterilized. Why they were not executed, that's still a big question for a lot of people. Some say because in the minds of some German officials, they really were German, you know, at least in some way. So, you know, I don't really know, but I do suggest that you go out there and do the research. But what I'm, you know, I suppose that I'm trying to go to, since I'm going on a tangent here, since I'm going on the first of probably many tangents that you'll hear this evening, It just really got me that, you know, he's, you know, like I say, he's a vet. He did his tour. I forgot exactly where he told me he served, but he was in country and while everything was going on, you know. And, you know, I mean, he's a conservative and that's fine. I mean, you know, we're pals. That's totally fine. You know, I'm not as, you know, I don't even know where the hell to put myself in the scale when I'm trying to, you know, discuss this with somebody in the Anglophone world. Because if you say that you're conservative, then they automatically look at somebody like, I don't know, Rick Santorum, you know. And I have nothing at all to do with Rick Santorum. And if you want to get into a people of color thing, Michael Steele and Herman Cain and Uncle Clarence Thomas and all of the other human lawn jockeys, no. See, I can't identify with them. I do not identify with them. And it's not a matter I don't want to identify with them. I cannot identify with them. I cannot identify with them. And if you're going to talk about a liberal, well, you know, I don't like liberals because, you know, if you're going to talk about Barack Obama, he's supposed to be representative of the liberal wing, which he isn't. You know, I mean, I'm like Phil Oakes on this. You know, liberals are left of center when, you know, in good times. But then they're right of center and hardcore conservative when, you know, an issue affects them personally. You know, he was totally on point with that. I agree 100% and see no reason to deviate from that formula. That is the way it is. I don't trust liberals. They go back and goddamn forth. And I hate to say this because I do not have a beef with white people, despite how this may sound and how many of you are probably going to take it because you're not used to hearing black people talk to you like this. You know, to the, you know, white listeners who are not used to this show. You know, it's the white liberal that is, to me, really the problem. Because, you know, he wants you to march. Doesn't want you to get upset. He doesn't want you to say anything. But he wants you to march. He wants you to sing and dance and do movies about it and create a play and such and so on. But he doesn't feel that you really have the same legitimate right that he has to struggle. Now, you can define struggle however the hell you want. I'm not into extreme measures. You know, I believe in nonviolence. I believe in conflict resolution. You understand what I'm saying? But what I don't like about liberals is that they make the argument that you should basically sit there and wait until they decide, you know, they, meaning liberals who are part of the extant system, until they decide that they're ready to make a change. And see, they tell you to march and to, you know, fill like they did with the Civil Rights March on Washington. Not the first Civil Rights March on Washington, because the first, not the first March on Washington, because the first March on Washington was the Ku Klux Klan. Remember that. The first supposed civil rights march on Washington was led by the Ku Klux Klan. Remember that. Remember that. And ask yourself why the Ku Klux Klan can still legally be in existence in 2013, let alone under a black president, under any president. With the history of this organization, that no one wants to call a terrorist organization, they are still allowed to, you know, get, if you cannot give money to WikiLeaks, you can't donate money to WikiLeaks via PayPal, but you can donate money to the Ku Klux Klan, no? You can donate money to the White Patriot Party too, I suppose, and the American Neo-Nazi Party. They have a lobbying office now in D.C. Did you know that? Did you know that? I mean, if you read the Southern Poverty Law Center website, and I don't see why you shouldn't, SPLC.org, and read their report on extremism for 2011, I believe it is, that since Obama's been in, that white power organizations, white supremacist organizations, neo-Nazi organizations, have increased by 400%. Are you really surprised by this? I'm not surprised by it. You know, and like I said, I apologize because frankly, I don't even know where the hell I started off when we came in here. But you know, like I said, this is what's going through my mind. So we're going to take a break so stations may identify themselves. I have no idea what I'm going to bring up when we come back, but we're going to talk about something. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned. To swallow me. He always reach out his hands.
We're not going to be doing a spiritual rap, although everything that is said from the perspective of the American Indian movement from the indigenous community has a spiritual content. I am not the person to address that in a direct fashion. I'm a political speaker. I'm a political being. Everything I do is political. There's the emphasis. And so where we go with that, and UAP Newton, is a definition of politics, and it's a definition I think we can all relate to, because in order to be politically inclined, we must first understand the nature of political consciousness. And politics, Huey said, was the ability to define a phenomena and then cause it to act in a desired manner. Simple as that. It's an exercise in power, but first and foremost, you have to be able to define the phenomena you wish to address and cause to act in desired manner. Without the definition, without the understanding, without the clarity of what it is we're about, we can accomplish nothing constructive other than by happenstance. And anarchists or no, we are not disorganized happenstance individuals. We have goals we wish to meet. We have objectives we wish to meet. It's not simply a matter of intuition. It's not simply a matter of emotion. Although intuition and emotion are both important, we demand, first of all, clarity. We've got a lot of power that's on the street. You see that power at the WTO. You saw that power in Eugene. You saw that power in Quebec. You see that power happening now in Sweden. I'm almost inclined to believe that the consciousness of the people, by and large, most charged up with trying to accomplish some sort of constructive change in the face of the WTO, in the face of globalization, in the face of all these things, is that the process at issue is something that originated in speech delivered by George Herbert Walker Bush somewhere around 1990 or 91. Not so. Globalization, corporatization, the whole process that we're up against here has a rather greater longevity than that. Now, we could go to peeling the onion in a Foucauldian manner, following Nietzsche. We're going to be all intellectual now. We're going to go back. Well, a precursor to the WTO, of course, was the Trilateral Commission. And before that was classical colonial impositions by the empires of Europe in various quarters of the world, encompassing 85% of the planetary surface and blah, 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 blah. And before that, and before that, and before that. Well, we can go, as Chellis said, back 10,000 years in peeling the onion. We can look for the origin there. I think you can probably find the origin conceptually of the process we're up against truly thousands of years ago on the first page of Genesis. You can start to understand it in the separation of man from nature. And that's the terminology used. The postulation that man is the signification, the personification, if you will, of God in the worldly dimension, not only apart from nature, but standing above nature, demonstrating this separateness and this supremacy, this superiority, this overarching entitlement by way of exercising dominion over nature, as will be signified by ultimately multiplying, growing plentiful, and populating the earth, a process which can only occur by way of displacing every other species, every other relation in the environment, and that being not only a goal, a noble objective to be pursued, but ultimately a divine enjoinder. Europeans were synthesized out of a multiplicity of indigenous peoples with relations to the land not dissimilar from those encountered among indigenous peoples here at one time, until the Holy Roman Empire was constituted by force of arms, compelling them to change their belief systems, their languages, and so forth, be re-engineered into something called Europe, which is an old Greek term meaning darkness and ignorance, appropriated as a signifier of triumphalism, and having accomplished that internal colonization, then projected the same order or disorder, as you will, outwards upon the planet. See, that part of European history, which didn't originate with the Greeks, there's 800 odd years of disjunction between the Greeks and the Holy Roman Empire. You got a falsification of history occurring right there. That aspect of what's called European history has been so thoroughly forgotten that there are very few Europeans aware of the fact that they are indeed themselves colonized people. The colonization of Europe in order to create Europe itself has been forgotten. And I would submit to you that it is impossible to be so colonized or any more colonized than to be so colonized have forgotten the fact of your colonization. Decolonization has to begin in a mental process of cognition. If you don't know you're colonized, you can hardly be about the process of decolonization. But in any event, following that, you've got a period of internal consolidation that begins to manifest what we are now up against in concrete terms along about 1450, with the attempts by the Portuguese to circumnavigate Africa to open a sea route to what they called the Orient at the time. They never made it during that period, but what they did find was something of value on the coast, and that was human flesh in the form of chattel. You got the advent of the African slave trade, and you got corporate licenses that begin to be issued at that time by the crowns of the incipient state of Spain in order to fuel an economy to make Spain essentially an ascendant power in the newly founded European reality. And you right there have this kind of confluence, interactivity, symbiotic relationship between a corporate entity on the one hand and a state entity on the other hand that is defining the process that we're up against today. If you want to understand globalization, you have to understand European expansion in the form of the outward Iberian projections into Africa and ultimately in 1492 into the so-called New World. You have to understand the dominion that is asserted over chunks of territory and peoples that had never encountered Europe before. You have to understand the appropriation of resources that came with that dominion and the development of the ability to project power in unprecedented fashion. It had never occurred before. It was not a factor in classical imperialism. This is a whole new form of imperialism and a projection of a particular set of relations, an order of understanding, an order of value and priority outward onto the planet in a form that had never occurred before. And it begins then. So the conquest of America, as Todorov called it, coincides essentially with the advent of the process of corporate globalization that has reached a particularly pronounced state of existence today. The nature of the beast that we confront today is the nature of the beast that native peoples have been confronting since a lost Italian seaman washed up on a beach in the Caribbean, half a world away from where he thought he was on the 12th of October, 1492, and got called the Great Navigator ever since.
This is Radio Anguindian. Anguindian Radio for the Fourth World.
Unisex Stereo is having a Super Stereo Super Sale, and it's super. The Super Catchy Catchy AM FM 8-track CB UHF VHF AC/DC 2000 watts per channel RMS Super Heavy Metal Amplifier Receiver, normally priced for a super low $119.99.95, is now on super sale for a super $1.240 at Unisex Stereo. Our new 800 watt stereo headphones with a built-in reverb and 200 yard cord, super sale price at a regular $78.88 with an everyday super unisex low price of $54.44, is now a super super low price at only $10. You can save 20, 30, 40, up to 50% on our everyday super unisex prices of 10, 20, and 30% off our regular super low prices. Save on our electric cutic wall knocker 16-way speaker systems. On our super glide automatic turntable with a base dust cover and a Hydromite light ride magnetic elliptical cartridge. Buy a $2,000 component system and get the phonograph needle absolutely free. Save on our 500-watt AM-FM clock radio. We guarantee you'll never oversleep again. And remember, everything here at Unisex is AC/DC. Unisex Stereo, open 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday, Wednesday and Friday, from 9 a.m. to 5:30 on Tuesdays and Thursdays, noon to 5 on Saturday, except on holidays when we're open 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and 9 to 7 and 10 to 6 on Tuesdays and Thursdays and Saturdays, respectively. Unisex Stereo, with one convenient location to serve you, 922 North 22nd Street, just under the 18th Street Bridge on the south side, a little east of West Avenue and South 18th. Simplicity is our middle name. Unisex Simplicity Stereo.
You can't bring up, one guy sent me a very interesting thing about Barack Obama and race. You can't bring up anything other than that suddenly he's African-American. If you start to, you know, delve around the edges of, wait a minute, isn't he mixed race? Weren't we told that last year? Whatever, biracial? Not allowed to say that anymore. Apparently, the mainstream media has dubbed him to be African-American.
Yeah, I was driving in today, and I was seeing, because I saw this piece with him on 60 Minutes, and I thought to myself, he is he's very white in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, gee, can I even say that? Can I even say that without somebody else starting a campaign saying, what does he mean he's very white? He is. He's very white.
When a Muslim without a birth certificate has taken over the White House, you need a good white former junkie to show you the direction that America needs to go in. Beck, it's What's for Demagogue. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a listen live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio, a nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
Hi, I'm Buffy St. Marie. We have overcome many obstacles in our history as Aboriginal people. We've survived. Today, we must work together, become leaders in the fight to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS in our communities. We have to think about the 7 generations ahead of us. It's a matter of survival.
दोपहर को कहाँ गई थी?
दोपहर को बाजार गई थी।
पता क्यों नहीं जा सकती थी?
अरे अब इसकी क्या बताना?
पड़ोसियों से पता चलता है मुझे।
पता चले तो क्या हुआ?
चुप! ये घर मैं चलाता हूँ। मुझसे पूछे बगैर कोई काम नहीं होगा इस घर में। धर्मशाला समझ।
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ। घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
This is Kristen Hirsch from Throwing Muses, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license.
I Don't Know More calls all people
to join in peaceful revolution,
to honor indigenous sovereignty,
and protect the land and water.
For generations to come,
Mexicans, South Americans, all indigenous people, get inspired,
take action,
and become a part of the solution.
It's my future,
your future,
our future.
We are the protectors of Mother Earth.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up and protect it.
Stand up
and protect our Earth.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
Do not sit.
And become a part of this incredible movement.
The time has come.
Idle no more.
Idle no more.
Idle no more. Become idle no more.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
We are the Ku Klux Klan. We hate niggers. We hate Jews. We hate faggots. And we hate specs. We don't have to have a reason to hate. People need to get off your ass and wake up. This is America.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
He says he's anti-Zionist, but he's not anti-Jewish and other things like that. It is very difficult to where he makes a stand on to separate what he actually stands for.
Let's try to flesh this out. He did make it very clear about what he considers the difference between Zionism and Judaism, or what is the real difference between Zionism and Judaism. So let's go to capitalism. He says he is against capitalism and for blacks. You can't understand that.
No.
Okay, let me have him explain it.
But all our problem is capitalism. I mean, either we suffer in America because of white people or capitalism. Which one are you picking, brother?
Well, he seems to have left us, but let me attempt to speak for him. Because of the collapse of certain governments in Eastern Europe.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
Because of the collapse of certain governments in Eastern Europe, the dialogue in the United States has less and less been a critique of the capitalist system. People assume that socialism doesn't work, has proven that it doesn't work, so if you're for blacks, how can you be against capitalism?
Oh, my brother, you know, let me tell you something now. The capitalist system doesn't lie some of the time. It lies all of the time. And for the last year, he's been trumpeting a little tune about socialism has fallen, socialism collapsed. This is nonsense. You never judge a system by its adherents. You do not judge Christianity by Christians. You judge no system by its believers. You judge it by its principles. If we were to judge Christianity by Christians, it should have been smashed millions of years ago, even before it came to Earth. Matter of fact, if you were to judge Christianity by Christians, then Christianity fell with Judas. But you don't judge Christianity by Christians. You don't judge socialism by socialists. You judge Christianity by its principles, irrespective of Christians. You judge socialism by its principles, irrespective of those who call themselves socialists. Where's the confusion? You think socialism has fallen? Don't go nowhere. It's coming right here to America because it's the only just economic system. There are only two economic systems in the world, capitalism and socialism. There can only be two because there's only one fundamental difference between them. Who owns the wealth of the country? Under a capitalist system, a few people own. Under a socialist people, all own. That's all.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Welcome back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. I'm your host, Angry Indian, sitting in with our engineer, Guadalupe Morales. This is the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, broadcasting to the international Aboriginal community from occupied North America. Subscribe to our international podcast by way of our RSS feed at feedburner.com/Aboriginal Press Radio. And we are carried by an ever-widening network of independent information providers not financially hamstrung by the corporatist news model. That would include Radio Free Kansas and Berkeley Liberation Radio. And I would suggest that you donate what you can, if you can, to both of those podcasts. They need your support to stay on the air. For more information on the news items and opinions discussed in this internet radio broadcast, please visit our electronic newspapers, beginning with aboriginalpressnews.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com, and lastly, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. You may also leave us a polite voicemail at Aboriginal Media Group via Google Talk, and you can always email our studios at aboriginalradio@lavabit.com. Now, I welcome back my brothers and sisters of the Fourth World, our non-Aboriginal ideological comrades, and the negative elements staunchly opposed to human justice and social harmony. But in spite of all that, they take the time to listen to this show on the sly anyway. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. And, what I was talking about was journalism. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say that I'm some, ace reporter that, is being overlooked or what have you. But, I'm a consistent grassroots, internet blog journalist. I mean, is that, Lupe, what we were talking about a couple of years ago? That we did use that for a while, didn't we? Blog journalism? And I think that's appropriate, but even then the terminology is getting crazy. I mean, when you really look at it, here you have the official fourth estate and they're out here doing crapola in terms of, accuracy in terms of reporting. And if you're in the United States, you actually have to skip The Guardian sometimes, even though they will have an expose on what's happening over here, which is something else. What is it with the British news? You go to the UK news, I don't give a fuck what paper it is unless it's coming out of Scotland, and all they have, everything for the first three or four pages, the three or four links deep, is just news about Americans. It's just news about the US. What the hell happens over there anymore? Does anybody realize that? How the United States is inundated everybody's goddamn media? And, we really shouldn't be surprised because the Western suit and tie is all over the goddamn place. When was the last time you saw a Mandarin collar on a Chinese official? Think about that. It's the same goddamn thing I say about Africa. I mean, they're all trying to be either Oprah Winfrey or Barack Obama. Who the hell shows up at these things dressed African? And I'm not talking about a baseball cap with a whole bunch of crapola on the shoulders. I'm talking about wearing traditional goddamn garb. African fucking clothes. And yeah, I'm tired of seeing black women in Africa doing reporting. I don't care if it's for Al Jazeera or fucking Press TV. With straightened hair. You know, does anybody want to be who the hell they are? Especially these folks who want to talk about God all goddamn day long, every motherfucking day, and shove that guy on your goddamn throat, you know, about every fucking thing. Whether it's, you know, homosexuality in Africa, whether it's, you know, let's get rid of voodoo, right? Let's get rid of traditional healers, right? You know, let's just ruin, you know, all of the harmony between Muslims and Christians and traditional people. You know, let's just destroy all of that for Jesus Christ. You know, let's just all move that over for Jesus Christ. And be done with the past and move on to the future where Walmart will give us the way to go as they sell African Pride hair relaxer. For those of you who are not aware, the hair straightening, the lie kits, because that's what they are. I'm not talking about lies and telling a falsehood, even though that is part of the shenanigans with this. That's part of the mishigas. African Pride is a natural brand name. And they sell hair straightening kits in the black community. Think about that for a second. And think about Madam C.J. Walker, who, you know, again, I'm not picking on Oprah, but, you know, she's out there and she's the, you know, poster child, right? Oprah Winfrey is the go-to person for the new black woman, right, in the 21st century, right? Well, she hails Madam C.J. Walker. Why? Because she was the first female millionaire in the United States? Well, I suppose that's laudable in a capitalist world. Because she was the first black millionaire? Well, I suppose that's laudable in a capitalist world. But how did she make her money? She sold these processing kits to black women under the ad. Because I remember seeing one of the ads. So that we can wear our hair like the pretty white women. That there is something ugly in your being who the hell you are, which is black, for lack of a better term. I prefer African, but we use black right now because I don't want to lose anybody. And yeah, so, you know, Obama's in Africa, and what the hell does that mean? You know, I'm going to tell you what that means. It doesn't mean a fucking thing because, you know, there's a lot of photographs and they want everybody to know that he visited Gori Island. And that he was there with Sister Michelle. And because, you know, but goddamn, you know, she's gullah. Her family came through that goddamn thing. Her family came through that motherfucker. You dig what I'm saying? Not his. Not his. See, the motherfuckers that his mama's family in Kansas bought came through there. Not him. So, you know, if he's going to talk about what lessons he learned, I don't want to goddamn hear it. Every 28 hours in the United States, a black man loses his life. Go to the Malcolm X Grassroots Report and read it. Operation Ghetto Storm. Every 28 hours, an African male loses their life during an encounter with police or white vigilantes such as George Zimmerman. And have you seen what the hell is happening with that trial? You heard the audio when you came in here. What the hell is up with that trial? Knock knock jokes? And do you see how they're treating Trayvon Martin's girlfriend? Do you see how they basically put her on trial? What is her attitude about white people? You know, what is George Zimmerman's attitude towards, you know, black folks? You know, I mean, everybody, you know, who was supportive of Zimmerman, you know, once you completely forget that he had no right to run up on him. He was told by the authorities not to engage him. And he did it anyway. So why is he not responsible? Why is he not being held responsible? And if he did get his ass kicked, which I don't believe. I don't believe it. Did they have a struggle? I'm sure they had a struggle. And like a punk, he pulled his piece. You know, and I've made that very clear, too. You know, I don't fear people who carry guns. See, I fear what they do. I fear what they're capable of doing. But I don't fear them because I know that they're cowards. If you live in a civil goddamn society, unless you're a peace officer, you have absolutely no fucking business walking around with a sidearm. You have no business walking around with a goddamn sidearm. And I'm really tired of hearing white guys talk about their rights in this respect. Because my rights are being violated by stop and frisk every goddamn day. Where are you? Where are you, constitutionalists? Where are you? You want me to come out and support you for this when you have no justification for this? You know, if you're worried about the crime that's happening in the hood, if you're worried about the crime, right? If you're worried about the street crime, because you're not obviously worried about corporate crime. A handful of you only worried about the crime that goes on and the corruption that goes on in government. You know, everything that seems like the white man is losing an inch is what makes y'all scream. I really don't get it. What the hell are you afraid of? What the hell are you afraid of? Are you afraid that some, you know, immigrant from south of the Rio Grande or Rio Bravo, depending on who you ask, is going to come out and get you? Well, you know what? If he's got a job, he has no reason to come out and get you. And if you don't want them up here, I'll tell you what. Make it so that Mexico doesn't have conditions that makes people want to have to immigrate. Actually, that forces people to migrate like that. Again, don't look at the symptoms. Look at the causes. Why do these people, Mexico has its own goddamn oil. It doesn't need the United States. It has its own gold and minerals and what have you. It doesn't need the U.S. It doesn't need Canada. What happened in NAFTA? That wasn't done to increase the economic and political stability of Mexico. That was done to increase the pocket shares of U.S. and Canadian businesses. What happened to the Mexican peso when the night that NAFTA went into effect? That wasn't done for the favor of the Mexican. That was done for the specific favor of the Western capitalists further north. Didn't have anything to do with Mexico. It didn't help Mexico worth a goddamn. And now there's Pizza Hut and McDonald's over there by the pyramids. I mean, you know, how much more damage can be done? You know, really, how much more damage can be done? So you want to wonder why these folks come up here, and then you got all this propaganda about how great it is up here and how free it is up here? You know, except for, you know, the Mexicans that live in Anaheim, California, around Disneyland, right? You know, you talk about Disneyland, but then if you're brown in Anaheim, you know, you can work there, but, you know, you don't have any freedom to walk about without being, you know, racially profiled. And what happened with that incident not too long ago, where dogs were sicked on parents who were trying to protect their children after another incident? You know, what happened with that? Why is it more dangerous for a young man of color to be in the United States than in Iraq or Afghanistan serving in uniform? And how many suicides are going down? And I'm not even just talking about the military. Another issue that no one wants to talk about. And I really, if I had thought about that, you know, Lupe, I would have mentioned that to him last night. Because he didn't want to believe the military sexual assault cases. And I should have asked him if you believe or you do not believe that, you know, vets and actively, you know, and active serving personnel are taking their own lives. Because they're that goddamn depressed. They're that freaked out. You know, look. They're running this entire system into the ground. For what? Who's making any profit from this? What are you gaining from this? How much was the petrol the last time you had to fill up your vehicle? How is anything getting any better? How are the prices getting any lower? No one's making any money. You know, there are people making money, but you know, it's not who, you know, who is it? You know, where I live, there are people living out of their vehicles. There are families in the United States with jobs who are living out of their vehicles because they're not earning enough with these fast food jobs to have a place to live. The United States. If you want all of this, you know, negativity to stop, you know, then you got to ask yourself, why do so few have so much and so many have so little. And do not be afraid to say plutocracy. Do not be afraid to say the five-letter word, class. You know, so where does this come into journalism? Well, because the journalism that we're seeing today is not representative of facts. It's representative of the will, and the wishes, and the wants, and the peeves, and the qualms, and all of the scruples, and, you know, motherfucking hypocrisies, and idiosyncrasies, and insecurities of the goddamn power system here. I mean, this is almost like the original goddamn Rollerball film. I'm talking about the original, not the fucking remake. I'm talking about the original, where the corporations ran every motherfucking thing. I mean, we might as well say that that's what it is now, because BP writes his own laws. Monsanto writes his own laws. The Koch brothers, they do what the hell they want to do, you know. They do what the hell they want to do. And we're just supposed to not say anything. I mean, don't tell me about conspiracy with what's his name, Snowden, whatever. And like I said, I don't know what the hell he's doing. I don't know anything about this cat other than what is being reported. And people calling him a hero. I think folks need to really look in and see what the hell's going on first. But you know, in any case, don't tell me about conspiracy. And then you have a punked phone call with Governor Scott Walker, where he thought that he was speaking to one of the Koch brothers. And I'm just going to say this because a lot of you don't know this, but you know, the Koch brothers, their daddy was one of the founders of the John Birch Society. He was one of the people that bankrolled the John Birch Society. And if you don't know anything about them, look them up. You know, and look up John Birch. You know, he was a piece of work in and of himself. And it's pretty funny. Here you have, like, you know, two individuals. You have John Birch, who was a mercenary serving in China. And then you have Pearl S. Buck, who was an American, child of missionaries, who I suppose was herself a missionary serving in China, even though she later on was sort of against the missionary work. Not missionary per se. She just felt that you needed a lot of Chinese to develop their own Christianity. Well, in any case, my point is, they were just so different. And, you know, that you would think, you know, the way we think in the West, right, that ridiculous dualism that Jacques Derrida brought out, right, you know, the horror of having one thing or the other, and then you have the indecidable. You know, because it's in the middle and it doesn't conform to up or down, black and white, you know, left or right, you know, good or bad, what have you. It doesn't fit the dualism or the linear thinking that you encounter or that you run into when you deal with Eurocentric ways of thought, I suppose, is the best way to put that. But in any case, and look up Jacques Derrida just because I asked you to dig. It's my favorite philosopher outside of Jean-Paul Sartre. But in any case, you know, you have this ultra-conservative, and then you have this other person who I consider to be, you know, an objective realist, who combined her realism with a sense of human compassion, which is something that John Birch, his compassion was limited to his politics and his religious beliefs. But what I'm trying to say is, if you ran into John Birch and he was able to convince you, or the work of John Birch, and that was able to convince you that that was the way to look at China as a Westerner or as an American, then I suppose that's what you have to go on, because first impressions count. Now, if you ran into Pearl S. Buck, whether you read The Good Earth or look at the other work that she did for women in general, and in particular the women of China, she grew up there. You know, you have another view of China that I think I personally view as more respectful. But, you know, again, it depends on how you get it. You know, and you have these two. And for a lot of folks, they get confused because here you have this and then you have this. How am I supposed to make up my mind? You know, instead of taking both views and then sort of finding out what's going on in the middle. So then you can kind of get the truth of what is true from either source, and all sources. And you know, one of the reasons why the journalists are able to do this to us is because we're not really looking out there. Now, you know, we got suckered here. I put on the Twitter feed and actually reported the story. Not my story. I reported what was out there after I looked around, and I was kind of curious as to why I was the only source. But then after Lupe, after Democratic Underground posted the same thing about Mandela was taken off life support earlier this week. Now, it turned out the story was completely bogus, and if it wasn't for the fact that I saw it on Democratic Underground, I wouldn't have reposted it, right? But it was completely erroneous. It was not true at all. And, yeah, it's embarrassing, you know, but at the same time, you know, bloggers and by extension, all journalists, and this is why, you know, I'm really not, you know, keen on the term blogger anymore. You know, all journalists, especially after what happened to Alexa O'Brien. Have you heard that? You know, her reporting, she's one of the only people that's actually doing any real journalism on the Bradley Manning case. And you can check out her work at AlexaO'Brien.com. And the New York Times used her goddamn research in a story and referred to her as an activist instead of a journalist. Now, of course, she was offended, but I mean, what is that really saying? Now, she's out here doing what they are supposed to be goddamn doing. You know, this is why a lot of people, and like I said, you know, you got Webster Tarpley out there, and I listen to him, and he's worth listening to. He brought up a point about Daniel Ellsberg. Now, I respect Daniel Ellsberg. There's no reason not to. But you have to take into account, too, that he was a hardcore conservative. And you know, and unlike a lot of the liberals that were talking a lot of things about, you know, whatever they were saying about Vietnam, Indochine, Vietnam, whatever, Ellsberg actually served in the Marine Corps over there. He was a platoon leader, I believe. And he did at least two tours. But I believe he did at least one, for damn sure. But he was a platoon leader. He had men on his command. And he was working for the Rand Corporation before and after he was in the Corps in country. So, you know, for him to make a turnaround, I'm not saying that it's impossible. But, you know, when it comes to these sorts of leaks, you know, because Edward Snowden, or whatever his name is, this cat here with the prism leaks, same thing with him. He's conservative. I mean, for people who think that Julian Assange is some sort of liberal, you got to be kidding me. Liberals don't do what they do. You know, liberals don't do that kind of thing. Conservatives do that kind of thing. And usually pretty hardcore goddamn conservatives. You know, but hardcore conservatives are kind of lean over to the libertarian bit. And what I mean by that is, I've said it before, I'll say it again. You know, they're okay with marijuana, they're okay with gay people, right? And, you know, they have that sort of personal liberty sort of thing, but they don't want to give up anything either. So, you know, that's where their conservatism, politically speaking, in North American terms, comes in. I mean, there's no Tory tradition here, so there's really nothing to compare that to. But, you know, that's initially what I was talking about with the journalism. You know, it's like, where do you go? Who the hell do you believe? There's so many bogus stories. And then even like the Daily Beast has come down on this Snowden guy. I mean, as a complete negative about these exposés. And, you know, what, I mean, weren't they supposed to be liberal? Right? Weren't they supposed to be liberal? Isn't the Daily Beast supposed to be liberal? You know, I mean, what the hell is liberal? You know, these terms, liberal, I mean, this is where Professor Chomsky is totally correct. Liberal, conservative, libertarian, progressive, socialist, communist, these terms, Democrat, Republican, I mean, these terms mean nothing anymore. The language has been so goddamn confused. Everybody, I mean, when you have Glenn Beck out here doing what he's doing, now civil rights, what the hell is civil rights anymore? Does anybody know? I'm not kidding. Does anybody know what civil rights, you know, what that means anymore? You know, when they removed the protections here for the Voting Rights Act, you know, I mean, John Lewis was like, hey, man, I bled for this. Right? Where were the journalists? Where were they on the lead-in up to this? You know, I mean, capitalism is that to blame? You know, is that hard to blame with this? But you have to ask, you know, who are journalists working for? This is the Angry Indian, and you've been listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Remember, brothers, Liberation is near, even if they do count our votes several times every 4 years.
Internet radio for smarter originals.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Traditionally, Native women made all decisions regarding their reproductive health care. This was respected as women's business. Today, we are basically denied this decision-making power. It's time to take back that power making decisions concerning our reproductive health. There is a choice we can make regarding unwanted pregnancy. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that must be taken within 72 hours after having unprotected sexual intercourse in order for it to be effective in preventing pregnancy. Contact your local Indian Health Service facility and ask if they carry Plan B. If not, tell them to order it. Plan B is an OTC, over-the-counter contraceptive, and a prescription is not necessary. You have a legal right to access this contraceptive over-the-counter. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante, porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
Transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 99.7 en FM.
Would you like to hear the lie that judges tell jurors every day?
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
In a criminal case, the judge instructs the jury, you decide the facts, but you jurors must apply to those facts the law as I explain it. And if the prosecution has proven the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must return a verdict of guilty. The problem with this instruction? It's not true. It's not true at all. And the judge well knows that, but most jurors don't. Jury nullification, the right of jurors to say no, to just say no to a prosecution, was central to the Bill of Rights. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson famously believed that jurors' right to nullify was central to democracy. Writing in the Champion magazine recently, criminal defense attorney Patrick Barone cautions that care must be taken when considering nullification because juries can use that authority to enhance and augment the power of the elite rather than to limit it. But, Barone continues, jury nullification can and should be a critical limitation on legislatures bent on promulgating and judges bent on enforcing ever more overreaching criminal laws. The take-home lesson here, criminal juries should know of their right to nullify because that power can constitute liberty's last defense.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union because freedom can't defend itself.
To the hood librarians, we ship the prisons too. We reach out and deliver to those that's bitten too, but it's more than a bookstore. You want it, we got it. Mixtapes, DVDs, and culture products. Black and Nobel got our hands in a lot of projects. You rock them all to come build the energy, it's positive. And remember, of the team, there's awakened conscious. Come through and experience this place of knowledge. They say they'll put it in a book if they want to hide it from us. But we got the book, so you can buy it from us. Something to read while you're on a train or riding the bus. Get your read on, food for thought, get your eat on. Black and Nobel, I buy my books at Black and Nobel. Black and Nobel, I buy my books at Black and Nobel. Black and Nobel, I buy my books at Black and Nobel. Black and Nobel, I buy my books at Black and Nobel.
तपाईलाई थाहा छ नेपालमा पहिलो पटक कहिले एचआईभी संक्रमित व्यक्ति फेला परेको थियो
थाहा छ सन् 1988 मा
यतिका वर्ष बितिसक्दा एचआईभी एड्स को क्षेत्रमा के भए सकारात्मक परिवर्तनहरू कति आए कसले के गरे
के हामीले आफ्नो जिम्मेवारी वहन गर्यौं
तपाईले गर्नुभयो जवाफ आफैसँग खोजौ जिम्मेवारी बहन गरौ
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास.
This is Howard Zinn. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced false news reports, imprisoned without charge, and tortured, targeted civilians, and used illegal weapons. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
DD is for everybody, not just for the few. Anyone can share DD with someone nice as you.
If you're curious or confused, get information or a pamphlet at most pharmacies or a health clinic. If you need help, see a doctor.
So, I'm in the back of a van with Trevor. Tell me a bit about the campaign you're involved with, Trevor.
I'm involved in the campaign against the British National Party, which has been particularly focused recently locally around the Red, White and Blue Festival, which is an annual BNP event that in the past has been held in Wales and in Lancashire. Last year and again this year, it's taking place in Derbyshire, a little village, barely a village actually, called Denby. So we're kind of building up a campaign against that basically to try and stop it taking place.
Okay, because, so this is the yearly festival of the British National Party?
Yeah.
Why do we need to oppose the British National Party?
And the British National Party is, it's clearly a party that in many ways has very nasty policies on immigration, law and order, all this vicious right wing. But actually it's more than that. This isn't just UKIP or the nasty end of the Tories. We're talking about a party here where the hardcore at the centre, the people like Nick Griffin and Mark Collett, are people whose pedigree is in fascist groups, putting on violent, extreme violence, control of the streets, racism, vicious racism, anti-Semitism, Hitler glorification, all the rest of it, you know. These people, I mean, take for instance Nick Griffin, whose background was he was a member of the National Front, the official National Front, the International Third Position, bizarre little sect, and then before he became involved in the British National Party and is now the leader.
Right. Opposing this festival, what is practically being planned?
Right. Obviously, this is a big thing in the sense that it's a major national event for the party. They've claimed to have thousands of people in the past. So what we've done is there's various avenues we've been pursuing. One is that this event, in order for them to be able to sell alcohol and play music, they've been seeking to get a premises licence, which allows them to do these things. I mean, they won't stop the event if they don't get that, but it would make the event much easier to do. So one thing we've done is we've gone through, partially through the official channels at the moment, so we've gone off and we've written the letters, but most of those letters have been rejected because we don't live in the relevant area. Licensing law is very, very restrictive on what you're allowed to use for your reasons. It has you can't really use political arguments. There will also, at the moment, we haven't heard this confirmed. There's a provisional date on the Amber Valley Borough Council website that the licensing panel will take place on June the 10th in Ripley at the, I think it's a town hall. And there will be a process outside that to try and anger. And then the longer term campaign after that is to, we've talked about trying, if we find out that any company is supplying the Red, White and Blue Festival, we intend to publicise that widely and campaign against them. And then in the event we're unable to stop it beforehand, we intend to mobilise on August the 16th from 9 o'clock at the area where this festival is taking place and basically make it as difficult as possible for anyone to get there and stop it taking place.
So you're actually talking about physically blocking the festival from happening?
Insofar as we have, it is August 16th. The festival itself runs from August 15th to the 17th. But a lot of people, because it's a quote-unquote family festival, don't like camping in a field and have work. So what we're hoping to do is cause maximum disruption at the very least on the Saturday from 9 o'clock. So in order that people turning up for that day and for the festival, try and stop them getting there or make it as difficult as possible.
But this does sound like one of the kind of bigger scale anti-fascist mobilisations in the UK for a very, very long time.
I mean, there have been large marches against, larger marches than this will probably be against the BNP. What there hasn't been, certainly as far as I'm aware, in terms of a direct process against the BNP, with the direct intention of stopping them doing something, I'm not aware there being anything on the kind of scale that we're going to need in a very long time, possibly decades.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, it's also very scary, but it potentially could be very important what we would like to see. I mean, the truth is that the anti-fascist movement in this country is quite weak. I don't think, you know, there are United Against Fascism, which various people have concerns about, Searchlight, which isn't really much of an organisation, it's basically a magazine with a few people associated with it, and Antifa, which has done some good stuff, but is still relatively small. We would like to hope, maybe, that what this is going to do is hopefully reinvigorate the anti-fascist movement in this country, because the BNP are getting themselves organised. They now have 55 councillors, and they're, you know, working on... They now have one representative in the GLA, and may very well have, after the next European elections, at least one MEP. So they're getting organised, and we really need to as
well. So it's time to take action, really.
If we don't do it now, it may be too late.
Okay. If people want to get actively involved in this campaign, they want to find out more, where do they go to?
Well, probably one of the best things to do, we set up a website where we're... if you go to that, it's nobnpfestival.wordpress.com. That will have all the information on it. There's an about page on there, which will have as an email address. So it will allow you to basically keep an eye on what we're up to. You can get and put yourself on the email list, and we'll send out any announcements. And there's also other information there, like it links to a page. There's a Flickr account, which for those people who aren't able to go and check it out themselves, can see what the area around the festival is going to be like. To give you an idea of what the kind of they'll need to be thinking about if they're planning on coming on the 16th of August.
And above all, pencil in 15th, 16th, 17th of August to keep free.
Certainly the 16th, and if people could do stuff on the other days as well, that we're not going to say no. But the 16th is the big mobilisation. The festival itself runs from the 15th to the 17th. It's at the Bungalow, Codner Denby Lane, DE58PT. You can Google it on Google Maps, find out where it is. You can get a nice close-up view of the close-up view from the satellite image, so people can find out where this is, and hopefully join us on the 16th, and who knows where else. So.
Excellent. Thank you, Trevor.
Thank you.
My name is Nicholas Soames. I'm the Member of Parliament for Mid Sussex, and I am the grandson of Winston Churchill. I've decided to lend my strongest possible support to this campaign because I am appalled by the dishonesty and the disgraceful way in which the British National Party have used Churchill's name, particularly during the European election, where they used his face, his features, his words as promotional literature, trying to pretend that Churchill would have admired and supported the aims of the British National Party. What they have done is not only dishonest and irresponsible, but it's downright misleading to try and pretend that Churchill would have had any sympathy with the British National Party, whatever. He would, I can assure you, have loathed everything that they stand for. Churchill led a national government. He was acutely conscious, as Britain's war leader, of the need to have a national government, to bring all parties together. And yet what the BNP seek to do is to divide all parties, to bring division and upset and lack of coherence to our communities by driving wedges between people. That is the exact opposite of everything that Churchill wanted to do in the national government. This is a peaceful country, and what they bring for it is uncertainty, fear and confusion. There is absolutely nothing that is British about the BNP.
Nothing British is a campaign against racism and extremism. Add your voice by signing our petition at www.nothingbritish.com.
I'm going to stand until I can't stand no more, if I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
So this is Troy Anthony Davis, and I've been sitting on Georgia's death row for 16 years for a crime I did not commit. It's been a struggle for me and my family, as well as the victim's family, who I sympathize with, really, because they have been cheated out of justice just as I have. They deserve justice more than anyone deserves justice. Because of Amnesty's assistance, as well as Arnold and Porter, you know, I'm still sitting here alive today, being able to have conversation. And I want to thank all Amnesty supporters, you know, all the volunteer workers. I want to thank everyone all over the world, you know, who has been praying for me, supporting me, writing letters and signing petitions and things like that. I want to encourage people to continue to sign the Amnesty petitions and continue to write letters and look into my situation, because this situation could have happened to anyone, but it needs to start with me. It needs to continue to let their voice be heard, because if their voice has not been heard thus far, the parole board probably would have went ahead and let me be executed. You know, my faith in God all these years has kept me strong, because in any other situation, had I not had God in my life and a strong family support base, you know, I would have been given up. You know, it's a couple of guys back here that dropping their appeals and saying, you know, they'd rather go ahead and be executed than spend the rest of their life in prison. And with me, because I have faith that God will eventually intervene and set things right, you know, it kept me strong. It gave me hope. You should never be able to convict a man or even indict a person, man or woman, without any physical evidence, none whatsoever. I would never take another human being's life. And this killer is still out there. My family's in mourning. The victim's family's in mourning. And the truth is still locked in because I didn't get justice. But in DNA cases, you know, that's physical evidence that you can test. I have no physical evidence to test to prove my innocence. But when these witnesses volunteered to come forth because their conscience was bothering them about the lies that they told on me, when they came forth and signed these affidavits, then that was evidence for me to test. When they took me to that death cell for death watch 24 hours before the execution, you know, it really affected me and everybody on death row, because you had grown men crying because they've heard about my situation. They know I'm innocent. They was like, they said, if I couldn't get no justice, nobody could get justice.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
I love you.
How much can we believe about the enemies of the United States? In Angola 10 years ago, and in Nicaragua today, we hear accounts of communist expansion. But are such stories true? Tonight, two former CIA officers tell reporter Christopher Hurd how lies invented about Angola and Nicaragua found their way into the world's press. Two experienced journalists tell him the difficulties they've had telling fact from fiction. Some people call this process disinformation, others call it lying. The CIA just call it a standard technique.
The Sandinista dictatorship of Nicaragua, with full Cuban Soviet bloc support, not only persecutes its people, the church, and denies a free press, but arms and provides bases for communist terrorists attacking neighboring states.
As they, you know, the saying that they have is that, this has been said publicly, by the way, by a U.S. government spokesman, that our intelligence from Nicaragua is so good, you know, that we can hear the toilets flush in Managua. And I've often thought that might be the source of some of this information.
Angola, a country at war, rich in natural resources, as large as France and Spain together, a left-wing government supported by the Cubans fights a continual battle against a guerrilla army backed by the South Africans. 10 years ago, the Russians and their allies sent troops and guns into a continent where they had no right to be. According to the newspapers at the time, that's how the Angolan war started. Or did it? John Stockwell worked for the CIA for 12 years, rising to the rank of colonel. His last assignment was to run America's secret campaign in Angola.
We had set ourselves well above and beyond the law, beyond the Congress, beyond the Constitution. We were lying to the President, lying to the Secretary of State, lying to the Congress about what we were doing.
1974, the Portuguese Revolution. The end of centuries of dictatorship and oppression at home, and of Portuguese imperialism in Africa. But as the colonies gain independence, in the largest, Angola, three groups vied for control of one of the richest countries in Africa. Jonas Savimbi, a friend of Che Guevara, but now an anti-Marxist, led UNITA. Agostinho Neto, a Western-educated left-winger, led the MPLA. Holden Roberto led the FNLA. He had been on the payroll of the CIA for 14 years, so he was the obvious choice for the seasoned campaigners back in Washington.
The CIA had just closed down three long-term paramilitary operations in Southeast Asia. Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. They'd had over 1,000 paramilitary case officers come flocking back to Washington. They didn't have desks for everybody, much less jobs, and morale was rock bottom low. They wanted a covert action. They wanted a paramilitary encounter. Angola was convenient. There never was a study done of who's who in Angola, who would be best for Angola, who would be best for the CIA or for the United States. There was no study done.
Well, the rationale was that the Soviet Union was trying to take advantage of the United States' weakness right after the Vietnam War. That Angola was getting its independence and they were trying to snap it up. And that Henry Kissinger decided that we could not be weak and we wouldn't let them do it. Our own files disproved that. We moved into Angola first and Russians were responding to us.
But before the CIA could start a war on the other side of the world, in Angola, it needed the approval of the National Security Council, a key part of the American decision-making machine, where policy is made by the top men in the government and the military.
The first briefings on Angola literally went, gentlemen, this is a map of Africa. Here is Angola. And then they went on with a chart to explain there are three liberation movements in Angola. One of them is headed by Holden Roberto. He's the good guy. We've worked with him for years, and they use literally good guy. Then the MPLA is headed by this drunken, psychotic Marxist poet, Augustino Neto, he's the bad guy. And they used exactly the good, so to make sure that people understood. And then, you know, like I say, you pack off and go off to the, and they come in for the next briefing about Micronesia or somewhere. The superficiality of what I saw fat old men dozing off in subcommittee meetings of the National Security Council, in which we were making decisions that were getting people killed. And I mean exactly the way students do in their 9 o'clock class, you know, propping themselves up and getting their glasses balanced so it won't look, you know, people can't tell if they're and their heads nodding off. And then you'd have to wake them up sort of to get their concurrence on. So I explained something to them again.
But the newspapers contain nothing about the fascinating way in which policy was made. Instead, they fell victim to Stockwell's worldwide campaign of disinformation.
The basic theme was to make it look like a Russian-Cuban aggression in Angola. And so any kind of story that you could write and get into the media anywhere that pushed that line, you did. One-third of my staff in this task force was covert action, was propagandists, whose professional career jobs was making up stories and finding ways to get them into the press.
From the CIA's headquarters, Stockwell put his propagandists into London, Lisbon, Lusaka, and Kinshasa. From the safety of such cities, none of which are actually in Angola, they wrote press releases for the FNLA and UNITA, which were fed into the ticker tapes of the Western media. The propagandists assiduously courted Western journalists, briefing them and wining and dining them. His man in Lusaka was particularly enthusiastic.
He ran a story that the city of Malanje had been captured by the UNITA forces, and in doing so it captured 20 Russian advisors, and they thought this would show that Russians were running the thing in Angola. There weren't Russian advisors. It wasn't a factor, and we knew that.
So I went to the British Museum's newspaper library to see how successful Stockwell had been.
And here's the story in The Guardian, under the headline, UNITA captures 20 Russians. The UNITA statement, with all its convincing detail, is quoted at length. And according to this, there were 500 Russians and other mercenaries involved in the battle. And there were 2 tanks and 3 armored cars. And even a house full of arms of Russian make.
The Guardian put quotes around the headline to show they weren't quite sure of the story, and presumably that's why they put a question mark after this hopeful little piece. The Malanje story also made it to the front page of the Times,
which quotes UNITA's claim that they captured 20 Russians in the battle for Malanje. The Times clearly believed UNITA because they helpfully tell us that Malanje used to be under the control of the MPLA. The source for this story was the Reuters correspondent in Lusaka.
I remember reporting that very clearly, and I should stress I was not the only journalist to report it. Many of us reported it, and we pinned it on an official UNITA communique. Years later, I discovered that a little CIA misinformation expert had sat in the US embassy in Lusaka and had composed that communique. And it bore absolutely no relationship at all to truth.
When you reported it, did you think it was true?
I had absolutely no idea. I mean, you've got to remember, at that stage, during a war, you're working under incredible pressure. I worked for 4 months without a day off for 16 hours a day. And all that was wanted was a flow of information. I mean, I'd done the same in the Middle East War. I was based in Damascus. And in the first week of the war in Damascus, I wiped out the Israeli Air Force 3 times over with official statements.
Reuters is one of the world's largest news agencies. Its offices around the globe provide many papers with their only source of news from some parts of the world. Many papers actually rely on the same person for their information, the Reuters correspondent.
Well, I mean, with hindsight, some of the official statements from the side I was reporting, and I stress from the side I was reporting, but also from the side that people in Luanda with the MPLA were reporting, clearly most of those statements were completely false.
Most of them were completely false.
I would think so, yes.
Doesn't that mean that for the average reader, we received an absolutely impossibly distorted view of what was going on?
I think that's a very fair assessment.
But newspapers were hungry for stories, and one of Stockwell's propagandists fed them well.
So he came up with another story, which he in fact kept going for weeks, and it was a good story in terms of the CIA's propaganda interests. He had some Cuban soldiers raping some young Angolan girls. Then there was a battle, and he had that Cuban unit cut off and captured. And then he had the Cuban women, the victims, identifying their rapists. And then there was a trial, and they were convicted. And then he had them executed by a firing squad of the women who had supposedly been violated, with photographs of young African women with weapons shooting down these Cubans. There had never been a rape. There had never been the military action. The Cubans had never been captured. It was all fiction.
Stockwell did extremely well with this story. Here's the Daily Express of March the 12th, 1976. Gun girls execute Cuban rapists is the headline. And quoting from UNITA, it says that 17 Cubans were executed, five of whom had been identified as the people who had raped four African women a few weeks before. And here's the Evening Standard, with a bit more convincing detail, saying the Cubans were shot with their own guns. And here's the Daily Telegraph, the newspaper of record, adding a bit more detail, identifying the region from which the women came and saying that they took part in the executions. The reporter was John Bullock.
I haven't the faintest idea where it was true, and I never said it was true. I reported somebody as saying that, as telling me that story. I certainly didn't report the facts. I reported Mr. A, or sources from such and such a group, as saying that. I don't know whether it was true. If you don't publish it, maybe it is true. You'd get, I should have thought, worse criticism for not publishing it than for publishing it. Because when you publish it, you do attribute it quite clearly and firmly to a man, a person who's saying so. If you don't publish it, you're already making a judgment. You're deciding it's not true. It's not our job to decide.
Editors are not going, and in most Western newspapers, are not going to be too skeptical of a Cuban rapist story. It sort of fits the general Western line and what the West wants to read about Cuba and whatnot. The truth is, all of the information we were getting was that the Cubans were handling themselves brilliantly and very generously towards the Africans.
Basically, and to put it very crudely, you can publish any old crap you like, and it will get newspaper room.
Despite the CIA's best efforts, the armies they supported never stood much of a chance once Cuban soldiers arrived in the autumn of 1975 to help the MPLA. Holden Roberto's FNLA and his CIA mercenaries were wiped out. UNITA and the South Africans beat a hasty retreat. Back in Washington, Congress didn't want another Vietnam and stopped Kissinger from spending any more money in Angola. Interestingly, some American multinationals operating in the country had always supported the MPLA. But when the corporations expressed their views to the American government, they were treated as the enemy.
When we went in, Gulf Oil was pumping the Angolan oil. We forced Gulf to stop. And the way we did this was by Henry Kissinger placing some phone calls and saying that he would open an investigation of international bribery by Gulf Oil Company. The fighting was effectively over in about February of 76. The Congress stopped us then and forced us to withdraw. By early March, within about 3 weeks, Gulf Oil was back with U.S. technicians in Cabinda pumping the Angolan oil, with Cuban soldiers protecting them from CIA mercenaries who were still mucking around in northern Angola. Now, years later, Western corporations are doing business great with Angola. David Rockefeller, Gulf, Boeing, Texaco is building a refinery there, De Beers, you know, working with the diamonds. They all lobby in Washington saying they have no problem doing business with the government of Angola.
But the war still goes on, with the South Africans financing UNITA. The Americans have turned their attention elsewhere, to Nicaragua. Unlike Angola, this is a country which any journalist can visit, so America's lies can be discovered more easily. But these have still dominated the papers. First, there was the arms flow story. According to Reagan, Nicaragua supplied guns to the left-wing guerrillas in neighboring El Salvador. David McMichael was the CIA's senior analyst on Nicaragua. They asked him to write a report on the arms flow. But when he looked at the evidence, it didn't support Reagan's claims.
The argument that we're dealing with here is, do these arms come through or from Nicaragua with the complicity of the Nicaraguan government? And the evidence does not sustain that.
Undeterred, the American government continues to insist that Nicaragua is a center of international communist terrorism. According to Reagan, it harbors members of the IRA, the Red Brigades, the Baader-Meinhof gang, and Basque separatists. So the American government has poured money into supporting the opponents of the Nicaraguan regime.
We have an obligation to be of help where we can to freedom fighters, lovers of freedom and democracy, from Afghanistan to Nicaragua.
The freedom fighters he is talking about are called the Contras.
Well, they wouldn't exist without the CIA. They wouldn't. They simply would not exist as a viable force. The Contras never even received money themselves to buy arms. That was all handled for them by the CIA. And there's no way out of saying that the Contra force is essentially and almost entirely a creation of the United States government. The Contras are agents of the United States government.
Since we have been there, since the very end of 1981 until now, has been a constant escalation of the war into our area. And there's been a great deal of real terrorism going on in the area. We have mass kidnappings. We've had whole villages that have been swept down on, and they take everyone, women, children, men, animals, everything that moves. We have had rapes and kidnappings, torture, murder, about everything that one could imagine that could happen in a war. And this has been carried out by the Contra.
That is, a standard technique in attempting to destabilize and overthrow a government, is to demonstrate to the citizens of that government, to the citizens, that its government cannot provide security for them. And this is the way to break resistance. And this is what they do. This is the famous CIA manual, Takayan. Laid this out very clearly for them. I hate to say it in this cold-blooded way, but it is a standard technique.
To help, the CIA has produced a Freedom Fighters manual. This shows how to make Molotov cocktails, how to throw them, and who to throw them at. It gives helpful advice on disrupting transport and communications and destroying property. Other standard techniques are aimed at people.
I'm very embarrassed by the United States support for the Contra, and I think it is illegal and immoral. They don't call Ronald Reagan Ronald, they call him Donald Reagan, which is a play on the word to donation, because everything they have is from him.
They are our brothers, these freedom fighters, and we owe them our help. They are the moral equal of our founding fathers and the brave men and women of the French Resistance. We cannot turn away from them.
Well, brothers, I suppose brothers and sisters, we all are of the same God in that sense. Certainly I wouldn't classify them as freedom fighters or as the moral equivalent of our founding fathers in the United States.
In 1981, the CIA asked McMichael for a report on the Nicaraguan press, opposition parties, and church.
And my conclusion was that, there was a significant space for these for these groups to operate, but that they were in no danger of suppression or disappearance. Compared to any other Central American country, Nicaragua has by far the liveliest opposition press and media. Over two-thirds, for example, of the 40-odd radio stations in the country are still privately owned and generally speak their mind.
When McMichael spoke his mind, the CIA didn't like it. He was sacked.
The Sandinista dictatorship of Nicaragua, with full Cuban Soviet bloc support, not only persecutes its people, the church, and denies a free press, but arms and provides bases for communist terrorists attacking neighboring states.
I certainly don't recognize any of the diatribes that have been made against the Sandinistas as to the persecution of the church, persecution of peoples, the denial of human rights. That is not in my experience.
After 4 years of fighting the Americans, the Nicaraguan government has now suspended most civil rights. In the world's newsrooms, they are more inclined to listen to the president of America than to the president of Nicaragua. So in the propaganda battle, the CIA's inventions still hit the front page. In 1982, they produced convincing evidence of Soviet bases in Nicaragua.
I used to laugh and say, look at that Soviet-style baseball diamond over there, you know. You know, this is almost foolish, really, you know, to talk about this. First of all, they're not Soviet military bases. That's the whole point. The second is that a barracks is a barracks. You know, an obstacle course is an obstacle course.
How about this for a story? Just under a year ago, the Americans discovered a Soviet freighter carrying MiG fighter planes, which they said were on their way to Nicaragua. Here's the story on the front of the Times. Moscow warned on Nicaraguan MiGs, and there's a picture of a MiG-21. According to President Reagan, this showed that Nicaragua was a threat to the United States.
And as it turned out, this was the evidence for this was based on satellite photography, which showed crates at an East European port facility, which were determined to be, in the science of cratology, the crates of the sort in which MiG aircraft frequently were shipped. And subsequent photographs a day or two later showed that these crates were no longer on the dock. And an amazing leap of logic was advanced that necessarily they must have been delivered to Nicaragua, or were on their way to be delivered to Nicaragua. Well, it's the usual thing. The charge makes the headlines. The retraction makes the inside pages. 8 or 10 days later, it's revealed, well, MiGs weren't on the way, but that's no longer a headline. So what one is left with is the overall impression from the screaming headlines of the week earlier that Nicaragua continues to represent this enormous danger to the security of the United States, this nation of 3 million impoverished souls, half of whom are under the age of 15, you know.
Well, I would say people are very silly if they believe everything that newspapers tell them, and I think probably anybody who buys a newspaper needs a course on how to read newspapers.
Part of my reason for coming out of the CIA is that it was a tragedy, a travesty of U.S. principles of freedom and democracy, that you would have the United States setting up a tradition of supporting dictatorships, brutal ones, forming and training their brutal police and death squads, while the Soviet Union, which has had periods of pretty harsh policies towards its own people, is winding up the champion of real freedom throughout the world. If you have a dictator and you want some help getting rid of him, you cannot go to the United States. You can go to the Soviet Union.
People in the foreign policy establishment, let's put it this way, and I believe this is not only true of my own country, but many others, you know, believe that in the interest of national policy, that it is legitimate to lie. They do not feel it is dishonorable to lie. And when they do lie well, they expect to be rewarded for it.